Firstly, welcome, as usual. You're very, very welcome. This is your, for many of you, this is your alma mater, your nourishing mother, the seminary here, and you're always welcome. Secondly, again, whenever I speak at these annual meetings, I congratulate all of you persevering. I don't know how many people say nice things to you for hanging in there. I'm sure some wise lay folk, every now and again, wise lay folks certainly know it and feel it. They may not always say it, but congratulations on persevering. It's not nothing. The reward will be, even for us poor sinners, immense in heaven if we defend the faith and stay by the service of the faith. Thirdly, be so good as to edify seminarians. Avoid disedifying them. They may or may not be possible always for you to borrow cars. The priest cars we may want to hold back for the priests, for airport runs and so on. But within the framework of seminary life, we will do what we can to reinvigorate your apostolate. Fourthly, I'm sorry if occasionally I give the impression of skidding out and running away from meeting or talking with some of you. It's partly, at least, because the seminary has to continue to run, and I'm occupied with the seminary. So, but I'm delighted to talk to any of you, and any of you are welcome to bang on my door if there's nobody there. I am, as much as I can be, at your disposal, and I do enjoy hearing what's going on and hearing from you. Fifthly, this little conference is by surprise. Some of you know that Father Calderon was due to speak. Father Scott telephoned me on Sunday night and said, what about plugging a gap? I thought about two other subjects, which I will actually evoke briefly, just to send up a firework in the sky and perhaps a little shower of sparks, because the two subjects are both interesting. Then I will get to what have finally said. I will say a few words about this morning, and that's the affair in Campos. The first subject I thought of was an American artist called Andy Warhol. Andy Warhol. How many of you is that name familiar? It's a scattering of you. Okay. He was an American artist, born and bred in Pittsburgh, of Czech parents, who began an artistic career in Pittsburgh, would have made a brilliant career in advertising, and made actually a famous career in quote-unquote art. He moved to New York, which is the center of the arts in today's United States. And insofar as the center of the art world is shifting from Europe to the United States, New York is the center of the art, of the visual arts, of the quote-unquote fine arts in the whole world now, like it's the center of many things. Essential, ideally one would show some of his art, which is really not great, but you'd get an idea. But the essential idea is quite simple. If you love and worship God, it will generate art. That's clear from the Italian Middle Ages, Giotto, Fra Angelico, and so on. It's clear from the pagan artists, the Greek art. The beautiful art arises, art which is beautiful always arises from, is connected in some way with religion. If you then worship art, you begin to apostatize from God, and instead of worshiping God, you worship the fruits of God, which are beautiful art. And there is a great deal of beauty in the best of art. There's a great deal of beauty and an aftertaste of God, which is deserving of, which since it's a shadow of God, deserves a shadow of worship. Not worship, thou shalt have no false gods before me. But if you're beginning to lose God, and if you want to lose God, it's very possible to make art into a substitute religion. If you make art into a substitute religion, it will generate museums. And you will build your museums like a temple. You will, as you lose God, you will build your banks like, and worship money, you will build your banks like a temple with huge pillars, with marble everywhere, very imposing and semi-religious buildings. The art museums become like temples. The concert halls become like temples. Because music is a form of art which again, at its best, is inspired directly by God, and is therefore at the least a shadow of God, and a carrier of an after aroma, an aftertaste of God. And if you worship music, you generate concert halls, whereas of course originally the music will be generated in churches, and you will build your concert halls also with very imposing marble halls. I dreamt I dwelt in marble halls and pillars, and there will be a solemn silence as you're listening to the sacred music, the sacred sound. It's a substitute religion. If you then worship museums, you're losing the sense of God in art. Your art and the museums are becoming independent of God. If you then worship the museums, because if you think that, like modern governments, the modern municipalities are liable to create, you know, you're going to build a library with columns, like just downtown here in this, with columns and halls. You're going to believe in education. You're going to believe in museums. You believe that these things are going to save society. If you make a religion out of museums, then it's going to produce emptiness. Because God is progressively being emptied out, and emptiness is where Warhol comes in. Warhol is a talent. I'd say, you can see that in his early work, I'd call it a second rank talent. It's certainly not a first rank talent. Picasso was a first rank talent. As talent. First rank. Brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. As his method and technique, as a gift of finding the visual form, a visual form for what's going on inside, brilliant. As for what's going on inside, ignoble. Warhol is less ignoble than Picasso and less brilliant. But Warhol is really the signal of the end of the worship of art and museums. Warhol signals the end of a false religion. The end of a substitute religion. The substitute religion is crashing, as a substitute religion is bound to do. Unless the only solution is to go back to God. And of course, when artists do go back to God, when Catholic artists, well, when they convert, when they become Catholic, when they go back to God, art begins to pick up again. And of course, in each of our little chapels, art is cranking up, excuse the expression, real art is cranking up again. It's cranking up again in the humble form of you whitewash a garage in order to make a mass center, and then you put up, you begin to find some images to put up, and then you find a choir director, Mrs. and you have enormous fights with Mrs. Because artists are always impossible people, more or less. But the choir director is a large part of the choir, as you very much know. But it's natural that Catholics want the music. They want to sing. And they don't want modern music. They don't want that jarring, ugly stuff. It makes no sense. Here's the mass. They're simple folk. Art is, that's where our real art comes from. And it's coming. And it will come. If tradition is not, extinguished by being crushed, and of course it will never be completely crushed, never, never. But if the authorities don't, and all the bad guys don't succeed in corrupting or crushing us, art, the music and the visual arts will continue to rise up, even in a very humble in form in our chapels. And eventually, if we were to persevere long enough, There won't be another Giotto, but that supposes a whole world given over to God, and that's not likely in our circumstances. But according to our circumstances, art is coming, or you can watch it coming back as best it can. The second subject I thought of, I can't recommend that you take a serious interest in Warhol, because there's not very much there. It's what he represents, rather than what he presents, that I would say is interesting. And what he represents is the crash of substitute religions. The second subject I thought of is the Frankfurt School. I don't know how... Hold on. The Frankfurt School. May I ask, how many of you have heard of the Frankfurt School? A mere handful, yes, a mere handful. The Frankfurt School, I've got here a very interesting little thing in French, the start of the Cultural Revolution, the Frankfurt School. There are bad guys deliberately, consciously, and skillfully corrupting the culture. This is an example, this is an overview and an example, but there are... they do not have the initiative. The initiative, the corruptors only, the initiative lies with in apostasy. It's apostasy is what prepares a situation where the corruptors can work. If the world wasn't apostatizing, the corruptors couldn't get anywhere. So the initiative is religious, the lack of religion. The lack of religion creates a situation in which the corruptors can go to work, and the corruptors assist to the best of their power the fall of religion. Therefore, to study something like the Frankfurt School, staffed and created mostly by Red Sea pedestrians, meaning those people who cross the Red Sea on foot, let's call them RSP, because we're not allowed to call them by their proper name unless we bow down and adore. Such is the state of society to which we've reached. So let's call them the RSP. These people are powerless if there is a sane and strong Catholic religion. They are rendered powerless to work whatever evil they may wish to work. They have to retire to their officine, their basements, and plot and scheme for the next century or for three centuries in the future, as they did through the Middle Ages. So no one is saying, or I am not saying, and I'm not doing anybody any senses, says that these people are determining in creating the corruption of culture. They are not determining. They are preying on a corruption which is already there by apostasy. For instance, Picasso was already producing degenerate art well before the Frankfurt School began to operate. Warhol is after the Frankfurt School begins to operate. But just to remember that there are people who deliberately plan to exploit and to promote the fall of religion and the fall of culture, the fall of Western culture, quote unquote, which is the fruit of the true religion. And what we've got today, if communism, political communism, is dead, quote unquote, cultural communism is alive and kicking. And the main enemy of our people today is not political communism, obviously. If you read now Divini Redemptoris, Pius XI's encyclical against communism, the problem's over. The problem is that it's over and it's not over. Of course, if you know communism really, communism is designed from the beginning to mutate. And it's mutated after the fall of the Berlin Wall, the fall, quote-unquote, of the Berlin Wall. It's mutated principally into cultural communism. Cultural communism, if you like, the corruption of culture, is something I think that all of us priests need to be aware of. And without going bananas about this being the real cause of all our ills, it's well worth knowing the game, being familiar with the game plan of these people. Because ab inimico dici, learn from the enemy. The enemy knows the soft points, the weak points to hit. The enemy knows where he can get leverage and where he can destroy what still remains of Christian civilization. And that's what's interesting. That's what I will read you now. To exploit as a Marxist the ideas of Freud, the cultural communism, the Frankfurt School, by the way, began operating in Germany in the 1920s. Very soon after 1917, the outbreak of political communism, the triumph of political communism in Russia, it was a meeting of some RSP, principally, in Germany, who planned to promote, since the political communist revolution failed in Hungary, Béla Kun, it also failed in Germany, Liebknecht, Rosa Luxemburg, Liebknecht, the communists hoped that as it had triumphed in Russia, so it was going to triumph in Europe. Political communism did not triumph. Mussolini stopped it in Italy. It was firmly repressed in 1919 in Berlin. Béla Kun, the communist government of Hungary, lasted about 100 days, and then it was out. The time had not yet come. So in Germany, some of these RSP got together to plan how to make communism triumph by non-political means. If the revolution was going to be blocked in politics, what else can we do? And the idea they came up with was cultural communism. Another name that you should know is Antonio Gramsci, and he's the Italian equivalent. And he was working, as best I know, I can't pretend to be an expert in all of this, but he was working in Italy in the 1920s and 1930s, and he was a communist. And it's he who planned a great deal, thought out in parallel with the Frankfurt School. Thought out and planned cultural communism. He called it, his famous slogan, the long march through the institutions, which is exactly what we see today around us, and is exactly what is so paralyzing our people, so crippling our people, so crippling the people from whom are drawn those who come to our chapels. The long march through the institutions, namely, take over the culture, take over the arts, take over literature, take over music, take over education, take over the universities. Infiltrate all of these Western institutions, they're not just Western, but in the present West, infiltrate all of these institutions, infuse them with our spirit, with our ideas, and we will so corrupt the people that then communism will easily take over. And that's exactly what we're seeing today. So what's interesting, of particular interest, as I say, in Ab inimico dici, learn from the enemy, what's of particular interest is to see what points these characters hit on as the means to dissolve what remains of the spin-off of God, what remains of God in this shadow of Catholic culture, of Catholic and Christian culture, and how to bring it as fast as possible to emptiness in order to have a vacuum that they can fill with their Antichrist. Let me read then. So the idea of cultural communism is one major idea is to cross Marx with Freud, both of them Red Sea pedestrians. They were born that way, but it has its significance, and therefore with a certain instinct, let us be under no illusion, with a certain instinct for the subversion of Christian society and civilization. And of course, they are an instrument of God, a scourge of God, a punishment from God for a society that's already allowing itself to grow corrupt and that gives these people the opening. The Lord God says, if you're not faithful to me, these people are going to take over. I've kept them for that purpose. I don't want them to commit all this evil, but if they use their free will to want to be evil, then they will serve my purposes by scourging the apostates, the Gentile apostates. And that, of course, is what we see. I won't again mention that who they are. To exploit as a Marxist the ideas of Freud, pansexualism, meaning everything is sex, that's of course Freud. Let's insist on this point, which constitutes one of the principal and directing ideas of the Frankfurt School. Freud, as summed up by Marcuse is one of the, M-A-R-C-U-S-E, is one of the important figures of the Frankfurt School. He joined them in Germany in 1932. I forgot to say that for the history of it, they planned these ideas inside Germany in the 1920s, and they played a large part, or some part, there was a great cultural corruption inside Germany, in the Weimar Republic, which somebody who is black and is the most terrible villain of all time did his best to get rid of. He replaced it with paganism. It wasn't that much better, but still. The rise of that man was very much due to the corruption that had been created in Germany. But when he came to power, these people had to run for their lives, and they ran to the United States. And the Frankfurt School continued in the United States, in California in particular, where they played a large part, these expatriate Germans played a large part in the building up of Hollywood. And that's why Hollywood is saturated in these ideas of corrupting Christian society, what remains of Christian society. Freud, as summed up by Marcuse: the essence of being is eros, erotic, where we get the word erotic, in other words, erotic love, the search of pleasure, pansexualism. B, Freud: the individual must accept the cultural control of his instinctive needs, otherwise there would be no civilized society possible. C, Freud: hence the conflict between the principle of pleasure, the free satisfaction of one's instinctive needs, and the principle of reality, the suppressing of these needs, the control of these needs. The Marxist is interested in every conflict, in dialect, and in anything that can raise conflict and dialectic. The idea that he has of civilization is different from the idea of Freud. The Marxist will leave out, he will keep that the eroticism is everything in human beings, but he will leave out the need for control. Therefore, the Marxist will use eroticism as much as possible in order to dissolve and break up the society that exists, in order to replace it with his. Freudian ideas will be used as an element of dialectic to destroy the existing civilization and to underpin a civilization setting out from erotic relationships and upheld by erotic relationships. Pansexualism will therefore be methodically developed with all its destructive effects. Freud merely systematized the pansexualism, whose origin goes back to the cabal. All of these things don't appear out of nowhere, and which is to be found also in pagan religions. It's a somewhat complex theory, but here's the essential. According to the cabal, God can be considered either in himself or in his manifestation. In himself, God is indefinite, called vaguely Ensof, which means no limits, or Ayin, which means non-being. In his manifestation, God is manifested by emanations, by which he is perfected. Hence the idea of an evolving God, the idea of pantheism, creation being replaced by emanation. The emanations that manifest God are 10 in number and are called sephirot, which will be surely another Hebrew word. 3 amongst them are male, 3 others are female. Fourthly, the sephirot Victory, who's male, and Gloria, who's a female, meet together in the sephirot Foundation, whose symbol is the reproductive organ. This is all foul. The interesting thing is the foulness goes back many centuries, and that the foulness is behind, there is a depth behind what's being pushed today. One understands in this situation that the principle of sex, presented as an integral part of the Godhead, tends to invade everything. The pansexualism of the School of Frankfurt and of the Cultural Revolution, to which that school has so powerfully contributed, being rooted in the cabal, then it has a religious connotation. Once again, if you fall away from God, something is going to fill the gap. If it isn't the three-letter word ART, it's going to be another three-letter word. The exploitation of the man-woman dialectic. Pansexualism, in other words, the unleashing of the instinctive needs of man, constitutes a first means of exploiting the difference between the sexes. But there is another which will be systematically used by the Frankfurt School: the overthrow of traditional relations between man and woman. This is being deliberately done by people who've thought it out and who want to overthrow the traditional family. The
the overthrow of traditional relations between man and woman to be obtained by the following methods methodically pursued. Beat down the authority of the father. Beat down the authority of the father. Deny the specific roles of father and mother. It's everywhere around us, and it's a disaster for the faith. People accuse me of, some people I'm sure, accuse me of naturalism. I have a comparison with a very expensive, complicated, and murderous, huge American helicopter, war helicopter, helicopter of war. It's a magnificent machine. It's bristling with machine guns. It will murder anyone within sight for miles around. But a helicopter still has got to come in somewhere to land. It can't stay up in the air forever. If the country is completely marshy, that's the end of the helicopter. The helicopter is going to need a solid pad on which to land somewhere. Otherwise, it's going to get stuck and it'll never take off again. Grace has got to come in somewhere to land. And if nature has been reduced to an absolute marsh, a stinking, foul-smelling marsh, a putrid marsh, what can grace do with that? Grace heals, yes. And only grace can heal nature, yes. But when nature is brought to a certain point, there's little in a manner of speaking. In a manner of speaking, of course, grace, if God wants to, he can throw Saul off his horse. God with his grace can do as he likes. But the justice of God will not allow grace just to heal nature anywhere and everywhere. Classic case of cultural revolution in the Old Testament. You may remember that the advice that Balaam gave to Balak, who was up against the Jews, the Israelites, was, if you can't beat them militarily, beat them culturally. Get them to sin. Get them to sin, and then you'll defeat them easily. Exactly the same idea. The Freemasons in early Italy in the early 1800s produce vicious, fill hearts with vice, and you will put an end to Catholics. The way to destroy the church is to promote vice. And so, if vice is promoted everywhere, it's difficult for grace to come into land. So these questions of the corruption of nature are not to concern oneself with the corruption of culture and with the corruption of nature is not just naturalism. It's prior to questions of supernature in a certain order of reconstruction. Beat down the authority of the father, deny the specific roles of father and mother, suppress the differences in education of boys and education of girls. Suppress the differences between the education of boys and the education of girls. It's common sense. But you'll get even Catholics who can't any longer see it. I hope all of you, dear fathers, see it. You know, I was saying a little while ago, girls shouldn't go to university. Nobody should go to many of these wretched universities today. But girls in particular, because education for boys and girls needs to be different. The culture, the destroyers of Christian culture know that to make the education the same will work powerfully for them. Destroying the difference between boys and girls. Or pretending that there's no difference. Completely falsifying relations between boys and girls. It's not a question of nature. It's not in itself a question of grace. But it has enormous consequences for questions of grace. Because the pad is destroyed and the most wonderful helicopter has got all the difficulty in the world landing. Suppress all forms of masculine superiority. These characters are planning this. They're putting their root. They're going down to the depths of the cabal and pulling up from ancient depths this muck in order to ruin what's still left of our Lord today. Suppress all forms of masculine superiority. Hence, of course, women in the armies, in the military. Treat women and children as an oppressed class and men as the oppressors. And of course, this is all these ideas are totally politically correct. It's the Frankfurt School that's behind things, the idea of political correctness. And as an underpinning for this overthrow, the ideology of radical feminism with pansexualism and the overthrow of man-woman relations, the promoters of the Cultural Revolution have at their disposal two powerful means to destroy the family. And you and I know the family is from God. It's essential for sane human beings. And of course today practically everything around us is pile driving the family into the ground. It's destroying the family. And so on. There are other interesting things in this little volume. If any of you want to know, there are books in English about the Frankfurt School. In fact, this French author has drawn mainly on American works on it. The Dialectical Imagination, The History of the Frankfurt School and the Institute of Social Research, 1923 to 1950, by Martin Jay, University of California Press, 1996. The Frankfurt School, Its History, Theories, and Political Significance, by Rolf Wiggershaus, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology Press, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 1998. Ralph de Toledano, The Frankfurt School, 2000. Jeffrey Steinberg, Draft Report on Manchurian Children. Gerald Atkinson, Who Placed American Men in a Psychic Iron Cage, Part 2, The Thread of Cultural Marxism, and so on. Eros and Civilization, that's a famous work, and that's out in public. Some of these are not, by Herbert Marcuse. The literature is there. These people are children of darkness. The fact that so few of you have even heard the name of the Frankfurt School tells you with how much success they keep themselves in the background, they keep out of view, just like many of the agencies that are seriously at work in order to destroy the remains of Christian civilization. It's the matter of one or two or several interesting conferences, surely. Of course, I repeat, all of the doings of these children of darkness is only secondary. Primarily, the question is faithfulness or apostasy. The initiative lies with the Christians to pick things up. If all of the poor Red Sea pedestrians in the world, if all of them banded together, they could still not stop one soul coming back to God if that soul wanted to. And therefore, you and I, who have to preach the faith, woe unto us if we do not preach the gospel, you and I who preach the gospel have the initiative over these poor people. And if we put the faith back in, they can't stop us. They will do their best, but they can't at the end stop us. So it's not as though they are bound to win and that we are powerless in the face of these people. It is that there is much to learn from these corruptors of what we need to defend. What they attack is what we need to defend. And therefore, for instance, we need positively to defend, promote the difference between the education of boys and the education of girls, because that's one of the points that they are deliberately falsifying. Ab inimico dici. I'll put it on the board for the last time. Ab inimico dici. Learn from the enemy. It's a smart man who learns from the enemy. Campos. I'm sure that very few of you are even tempted by the kind of agreement which Campos has got into. Again, I take upon myself to congratulate you. And I think that there are priests throughout the society. If I may say, a grassroots level priest throughout the society. There's a lot of priests, I think, a grassroots level in the society who don't want any kind of agreement like that with Rome. We would all like things to be straightened out with Rome, but I think most of us see that like Archbishop Lefebvre saw, I think most of you see that there's a major problem of faith. And this problem of faith can't be got around. It's not going to be got around with smooth words. It's no use two people shaking hands across a chasm. There they are shaking hands when there's a huge chasm underneath dividing them. It's a purely superficial surface agreement. It's nothing. You can't solve the problem of the chasm by shaking hands on a particular point where the two just come together. That's not it. We've got a major problem here. That's in brief it. One who put this problem very well, I don't know if all of you read the Angelus, but it's it's the Brazilian priest, Father Lawrence Fleischmann, who his open letter to the priest of Campos, which he wrote at the end of October, and it's in the latest Angelus, and it's in English. It's been translated into English. Father Fleischmann was originally a Benedictine with Don Girard in south of France. That was the traditional Benedictine monastery, which got going from the 1970s under the patronage and with the encouragement, but essentially independent of, completely encouraged by, virtually created by Archbishop Lefebvre, and yet intrinsically independent of the society. The Archbishop created, promoted, helped these initiatives, but he did not pretend to keep control of them. And the proof is that in 1988, Don Girard quit the society. Don Girard separated from the society. In any case, it's the Archbishop who, by ordaining Don Girard's candidates, for all the way from about 1976, I was ordained, I think, the first companion priest of Don Girard, Father de Jean de Bell something. But through those years, the Archbishop performed the minor orders, the subdeacons, the deacons, the priests. You could say that Don Girard's monastery was virtually the creation of Archbishop Lefebvre. Without Archbishop Lefebvre, if there would never have been the monastery. Now, come the consecrations of 1988, and Don Girard decides to make a separate agreement with Rome. Father Fleischmann was in the monastery at the time, I believe. I can't remember if he was already a priest. Possibly he was. In any case, there was a handful of priests that separated from Don Girard and came back to the Archbishop and came back to tradition. Amongst them, of course, was Dom Cyprian, who we know in New Mexico. Don Girard had founded, before 1988, he had founded an offspring monastery in Brazil, a new Fribourg. Not in the Diocese of Campos itself, but not far from the Diocese of Campos. And that's where Don Fleischmann took refuge as other Benedictines when Don Girard went over to Rome in 1988. The Archbishop wept. There's a point in time when the Archbishop wept at Don Girard's defection. But there you are, these things happen. And Don Fleischmann was at the monastery. He didn't stay in the monastery, but he stayed in the area. He stayed in Brazil, and all of these years, he's been running two little chapels in the area of Rio de Janeiro, two little Tridentine Mass chapels in the Niterói and Rio. And he mentions these little chapels in his letter. His letter is excellent, absolutely excellent. Most Reverend Bishop Rangel and very dear Father. So he's been on his own, virtually, running two little chapels. He's been a downtrodden, ignored, lonely, misunderstood priest saying the Tridentine Mass for handfuls of people in whitewashed garages, but the faith is there. Listen. Actually, his chapels may be much better than whitewash. There probably is some quite nice art in there, but in any case, I'm creating a scenario just so that some of you should be able to feel an empathy with him. We are all of us downtrodden, misunderstood, lonely. I'm just a lonely boy. I'm just a lonely, lonely and blue. Some of you may know these old songs. They somewhat date me. They go back many years. I'm just a lonely boy, lonely and blue. That's what a traditional priest can sometimes feel. And that is, in a way, is what Don Fleischmann is, because he has been very much on his own for quite a few years. But by golly, as they say in French, he hasn't lost north. His compass still reads perfectly true. Listen. Most Reverend Bishop Rangel, very dear fathers, I am not the best placed person for writing you this letter. I do not think that I shall obtain from you the assent that you declined or refused to the bishops of the Society of Pius X, Bishop Furley and Bishop de Galarreta, when they tried to show you the fearful damage that this agreement between you and the Vatican could inflict on the Church and on the fight for the survival of tradition. Nevertheless, I have a very serious reason for writing you about this, and I do so with the advice and approval of Bishop Fuller himself. The reason is that several of our faithful at the two little chapels that he serves in Niterói and Rio come from villages that you are responsible for, and they have always held the Campos Fathers in the highest esteem and reverence. Now they cannot manage to understand the reason for an agreement with Rome being made separately from the Societas Pius X, and which moreover goes against the counsel and advice of the society bishops. Another reason that encourages me to write to you is the experience I lived through in 1988 at Le Barou, when Don Gérard Calvé too also wanted to make a deal with the Vatican separately from the society. Here is the first similarity I see between Don Gérard's attitude, that was the Benedictine prior, and yours. Archbishop Lefebvre in 1988 had just refused an agreement because he had not been able to see in the Vatican's intentions the guarantees that would be necessary to ensure the survival of Catholic tradition. Don Gérard, placing the particular interests of his monastery above the church's good, accepted a separation from Archbishop Lefebvre in order to, quote-unquote, normalize his juridical and canonical status, thereby dropping the sword of combat. Today, equally, the Societas Pius X has just rejected an agreement with Rome for the same reasons as Archbishop Lefebvre, this gigantic problem of faith, this gigantic and could not be more deep problem of faith. Because the problem of faith in Rome is a softening of the brain. It's an attacking of the very notion of truth. Not just Catholic truth, any notion at all of truth. And there you've got a classic example of a marsh on which a helicopter can't land. You can pour the most wonderful theology into these rotten heads, these modern rotted heads, and of course it's going to, the wonderful theology is going to come out modern rotted. As Pascendi indicates, the basic problem with modernism is not even a problem of grace. Understand that rightly. It's a problem of nature. It's a problem of rotted heads. Heads rotted by Immanuel Kant, by Kantism. Il Kantismo e l'eresia moderna, said Pius X. Kantism is the modern heresy. And he nails it in Pascendi. Pascendi starts out, the whole gigantic analysis of Pascendi, you may remember, starts out from phenomenist agnosticism, or agnostic phenomenism. The idea that we cannot know, the mind is incapable of grasping the object, or the objective truth. There is no objective truth for these people. How can you possibly negotiate with somebody for whom there isn't objective truth? For whom there isn't objective truth? For him, what he negotiates today is perfectly capable of being exactly the opposite tomorrow, without it being for him changed. These people they're not clinically mad. Clinically, they look sane. But ideologically, intellectually, they are mad. Their heads are unhinged. Just like a door, if it's taken off its hinges, it can only lie flat on the floor. These brains are off their natural hinges. And that's the first problem that has to be cured. And it's very difficult to cure. Very, very difficult to cure. Père Valette, who was a saint without any doubt of the 20th century, you may have heard that quotation before, he used to say, un libéral est inconvertissable. A real liberal is unconvertible. Like a real Kantian is unconvertible, because his system is such that any objection that you throw from the outside, he's got a way of fitting it into the orbit of his planet, and your objection will enter into his system and spin around his planet. So what can you do? You may remember the example from Pascendi of how the modernists have got the Pope objecting tied up in advance. If the Pope condemns their system, that's simply a healthy reaction of the backward part of the church to excesses on the part of the forward part of the church. But we'll just sort of fit the two together, and that way we will go forward at a reasonable speed instead of at an excessive speed. In other words, the reaction of the tradition. If the Pope says modernism is rotten, modernism is ugly, yeah, go on, that's it, that fits into our system. We need you to say that, because that will stop us going too far too fast. And that, of course, is why Ratzinger wants the society back in with Rome, because they need us to put brakes on the wild guys. It's incredible. But an objective truth, independent of us, independent of the wild guys, independent of anybody except God, forget it. Their minds are incapable of such a concept. Incapable. And you want to try to negotiate with these people? You want to try to fix an agreement? How can you fix an agreement with heads which are totally unfixed? Heads and hearts and minds totally unfixed. This is the problem. Surely, dear fathers, I think I'm pushing on an open door. You and I meet this all the time amongst our poor people. Their heads are just, you've got to fix their heads. And of course, in how do you start a real cure of that? Attending, as you know, in concreto, attendance at the Tridentine Mass. Because that's reality. There is the real sacrifice. The real God really sacrificing in body, blood, soul, and divinity. That's real. And it gets through. There's the beginning. Of course, there's grace beginning to heal nature. But what grace will have to do is firstly clean up the natural mess. And the glimmer will come that there is a reality here. There's something that's independent of me, much higher than me. And then, of course, 3 weeks, 3 months down the pike, I ought to go. Reality begins to come back. And then, of course, if the state of grace comes back, then light begins to come back. So grace can heal nature, of course. Grace does heal nature. Grace alone can heal nature. But it's a natural problem that has to be healed. You prefer to consider today equally. The society has just rejected an agreement for the same reasons as Archbishop Lefebvre, and you prefer to consider your particular interests and not the common good of the church. You have grown weary of the daily fight and of being pushed to one side, marginalized. But the similarities do not stop there. When your fraternity was conducting, that's the Union of Priests of St. John Marie Vianney, when your fraternity was conducting the current negotiations, I spoke to Father Fernando Rifan, who's like the front runner of the group alongside Bishop Rangel. Bishop Rangel is, of course, the hierarchical head, but kind of the public front runner with brains and with languages and travel is Father Rifan. Father Rifan, who I've, you know, we've known, the society's known him for many years, he's a gifted man, he's a musician amongst other things. He gave me three reasons that he considers sufficient for going ahead and concluding the agreement, even though the Vatican has not agreed to allow the Tridentine Mass. That's a reference to the precondition that Bishop Foley and the Society of Science and Tenth put upon talking with Rome. Remember, some of you may lose it because it's something that gets confused, possibly deliberately confused. When Bishop Foley said to Rome, there are two preconditions, the liberation for all priests in the entire church, of the liberation of the Tridentine Mass, let any priest anywhere, anytime, be able to say the Tridentine Mass without any problem. Secondly, the lifting, quote-unquote, of the quote-unquote excommunications. Those two were preconditions, not for an agreement. They were preconditions for sitting down at a table with the Romans to begin talking about an agreement. That's an important difference. The media and other people, the idea is getting around and circulating that was a precondition for an agreement. Because the media want an agreement. The media, they want to pretend that an agreement, that there isn't a huge gulf. And of course they want to pretend that there's not a huge gulf because they want everybody on the wrong side of the gulf. They want everybody in the gulf. So, even though the Vatican has not agreed to allow the Tridentine Mass, here are Father Rifan's three arguments. One, many new persons would rejoin tradition. Two, we would have a foot in the door of modernist Rome for preaching tradition. Three, we could still go back to our former position in case we were unduly pressured. Don Lawrence goes on to say, these are exactly the same arguments as those of Don Gerard in 1988. As they say in French, plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose. The more things change, the more they are the same. To me, shockingly similar. Firstly, because then, at that time,
you, Bishop Rangel, and these campus priests, you knew how to critique Don Girard's position, as was so necessary at the time. Father Rifan. You, Father Rifan, knew how to critique Don Girard's position, as was so necessary at the time. Second, because today, the logical conclusion you were obliged to reach is that Don Girard was right. You've taken up exactly his argument. He preceded you by 10 years, which obliges you to believe that his assessment then was better than yours now. His assessment then was better than yours then. In answer to your arguments, I think the following is undeniable. One, first argument of Father Reeson, many new persons would rejoin tradition. One, the new people that will join you will not desire to convert to true tradition. They will come to you because the legal obstacles have been removed and not for reasons of faith. They will be very sympathetic, but they will not be seeking the whole truth with the doctrinal conviction that leads souls to martyrdom. That's magnificently said. People that have been scared, people today that are scared by the various obstacles put, the barbed wire that Rome puts around us, people that don't go through that barbed wire by hook or by crook in order to get to us, are respectful of Rome. If they're respectful of Rome in the wrong way, they've not understood the real problem. If they understand the real problem, which is that Rome is out of its Catholic mind, then while honoring Rome as Rome or deserves all honor, they sit on the chair of Moses. They must be honored as sitting on the chair of Moses. While respecting in the way that they should be respected, one will not pay attention to their delinquent attitude towards the real faith. And if I do pay attention to that, it's that I am missing out on what is the real faith. And if then a lifting of suspensions and a lifting of excommunications would let a whole lot of people come back to us, it's not the people that we need today for the defense of the faith. These hurdles today that Rome has put around us are serving magnificently to sift out the people that really have the faith from those that don't. That's what he says. The Romans will be very sympathetic. The people that would come to us in that situation would be very sympathetic. We were very nice people. Oh, nice. As nice as you like. As nice as pie. But they will not be seeking the whole truth with the doctrine, with the doctrinal conviction that leads souls to martyrdom. You and I, my dear fathers, we have got to be today preparing souls for martyrdom. We have got to be, not even directly, because God may not want that, but we have got to be fortifying, preaching the faith and fortifying people in that faith which is capable of martyrdom. Nothing less. And if we're not doing that, only a doctrinal conviction, as far as Don Lawrence says, it can't be a question of feelings. It's a question of doctrine. It's got to be doctrinal. We've got to preach the real doctrine without any compromise. And it's not a question of numbers. It doesn't matter how many or how few followers. It doesn't matter. It's a question of the purity of the faith. Much better to preach the pure faith to 10 people than to preach something a little watered down to 1,000. Because tomorrow, it's only those 10 who are going to count. It's only those 10 who are going to hold, and it's only those 10 who are going to count. The 1,000, God doesn't know what to... God. They don't. They're dear souls. Each one of them is an immortal soul. Each one of them needs to be saved. But if there aren't those 10, there'll be no way of saving those thousands. Second argument of Father Rifan. We would have a foot in the door of modernist Rome. Oh, let me quote you the Archbishop on this point. The Archbishop said it back in 1988. He said, one of the arguments that was put to the Archbishop to encourage him to go into an agreement was that he would have a lot more seminarians. And the Archbishop said, in his quiet way, without raising his voice, he said, the traditional Benedictine prior Don Girard tells me that an agreement with Rome would have opened up for us a huge field for the apostolate. Maybe. But in a world of ambiguity, facing in two directions at once, which would make us go rotten in the end. That's it. They insist. But if you were with Rome, you would have more vocations, unquote. The Archbishop goes on. But vocations like that, if you breathed one word against Rome, if you had your seminary full of vocations like that, or even half full of vocations like that, you then breathe one word against Rome, and it would make life in our seminaries impossible. And if we, quote unquote, came to an agreement with Rome on that basis, then the diocesan bishops would say, come along and join us in our dioceses. And little by little, tradition would be eaten up, would be compromised. That's it. That's it. He said again the following day, it's that little flyer, the Episcopal Consecration, the 3rd of June 1980, 10th anniversary. Two unknown texts of 12th and 13th June 1988. So clear, so quiet, so tranquil, so clear, why an agreement was impossible in 1988, and why any such agreement today is for a Catholic unthinkable, because whatever the appearances, these people in Rome have profoundly un-Catholic minds. And what's so deceptive is that the modernists can keep all of the appearances of Catholicism. It's the depth, but in the depth there's no similarity at all between a Catholic who's convinced of an absolute objective truth and a quote-unquote Catholic who's convinced of no such thing, that everything is subjective, everything is relative, everything is up for grabs, everything is changing, everything is evolving, everything is moving. There's no meeting of minds possible. And where no meeting of minds is possible, how can there be an agreement? It's an absurdity if you stop and think about it. But you have to stop and think about it. And you have to understand the diabolical subtlety of modernism. How can minds reach that point? Well, you have to read Pascendi. Second argument of we would have a foot in the door of modernist Rome for preaching tradition. Answer of Don Lawrence. Being in modernist Rome, and this is proved, invariably results in contamination by the guiding principles of Vatican II, administered in homeopathic doses until the fruit falls, like St. Peter's Fraternity. Brilliantly said. Homeopathic doses. Oh, they're nice. And they'll be so nice to us. And the medicine to make us go modernist will be so sweet. And it will be so easy to drink. And everything will be made so easy. Until the fruit falls. Until we drop into conciliarism. Until we drop into the new religion, the new church. And so he says, that we can't associate with Rome. It's not possible. If you go down there, you've got to take care, take great care every time. Somebody who talks very well about that is John Vanari. John Vanari once went to Rome with Brother Joseph out from New Jersey. And he describes meeting Cardinal Meyer. And he describes meeting some of these churchmen. And he said to me the other day, because I was talking about it, he says that these churchmen, how did he put it? They're living in an unreal world. That's it. That's what Vanari said. They're living in an unreal world. They think it's the real world, but it's got nothing to do with the real world. They are living in a space bubble. They're freaked out. Rome is freaked out. Or you'd say in California, Rome is spaced out. It doesn't look like it. They look serious men. They look as though they're in control. There they're sitting at the levers of power, and they, you know, everything looks normal. It's totally abnormal. It's incredible. John Vanari saw it. Talk to him if you want to get him. It's interesting what he says, and that's direct experience of what the Romans are like. They're mad. They are out of their minds. How can you talk with people like that? Third argument of Father Rifan, we could still go back to our former positioning if we were unduly pressured. In other words, we could always step backwards. We could get involved with Rome, we could always get uninvolved again. Answer of Don Lawrence. As for going back, who amongst those that have fallen into conciliarism have ever climbed back to their former position outside of it? They would rather concelebrate with the Pope than go back. And if they did go back, what would become of the faithful in their parishes? They're right now leading all of their people with them into Rome, and in 6 months' time they're going to say, okay guys, march back again, and all of the faithful are going to walk quietly back out again? Get real.
Would they all go back? How many would be entangled over the question of legality? You've told them that we've got to go back. You're telling them we've got to go back with Rome because we're illegal where we are, and that's what you're telling them now, we're illegal. And then in 6 months' time, you're going to tell them that legality doesn't matter. What do you think? How do you think people are going to react? How do you think your people are going? How do you think souls are going to react? I consider such an attitude reckless, says Don Lawrence. It does not take into account the constancy of the souls that Providence has entrusted to you, the Campos faithful. You've been leading them out, quote unquote, outside of Rome for all of these years, persuading them of the arguments. The Angelus published 2 years ago, a year or 2 years ago, a recent little work about why we need to stand off Rome. And now you're saying, no, that wasn't right. In fact, we should be going in with Rome. And then in 6 months, you're going to go back to where you were? Come on. You regularize on paper a phony problem of excommunication, and the faithful have only to follow and to obey. And then, tomorrow, you're going to about face and ask them to retreat with you? Unreal. I cannot quite see in this the respect for souls that the priestly life requires. With regard to the Cistercian Pietas, I do not understand how you can so obstinately refuse the requests of these bishops who have come to your aid time and time again. This is a personal argument which is not anything like as important as the objective argument. The objective argument is the one that matters, not they are betraying the society, weep, weep, weep. Oh. I don't mind anybody who kicks me in the backside 10 times a day if he's a good servant of God. It's God that matters, not the society. But anyway, it is an argument, and it comes best from somebody who isn't a member of the society, of course. So, first, there was the consecration of Bishop Rangel, a very courageous act by these bishops, for many could misunderstood the act, as was the case. It was by thinking of you and your faithful that they agreed to the consecration. Also, the seminaries of the society have always been open to the Campus Seminarians. They're received as brothers. And then, when the society was summoned to negotiate with the Vatican at the beginning of 2001, you were amiably invited to participate in the meetings of the society's superiors. They were not obliged to include you, yet once again they were generous and fraternal in the Frank tradition. In view of these facts, by refusing to listen to the supplications of the society, you incur the terrible burden of betrayal. In that, once again, you match Don Gerard. Perhaps you do not see the matter thus, but neither can you deny the bishops the right to feel betrayed. Betrayal of God, now that matters. Betrayal, comparatively, it's unimportant. This is the problem. Not this. Not the society and its seminaries and this. That's not the problem. This is the problem. The gigantic gulf, the chasm, the abyss between the Catholic mind and these minds in Rome. They're not even natural minds. They're unnatural minds. They are profoundly unnatural minds. The mind unhooked from its object. St. Thomas Aquinas says, you may remember, the object is the act of the mind. The mind without its object is a mind only in potency. The object is what actuates the mind. So of course thinking is objective, because it's thinking is either objective or it isn't. It isn't. There's no thinking. There's only a potency for thinking. That's how the mind really is. And then, and just as Don Gerard's betrayal caused a terrible drama amongst the French faithful, causing divisions in families and deep disappointment because of this abandonment and weakness, likewise you also today are for the Brazilian faithful the cause of the same disappointment and the same divisions. Yup. The effect amongst the people. That's a serious argument. I said in 1988 to Don Gerard what I repeat to you today. Thousands of the faithful anxiously wait for you to confirm them in the Catholic faith, in the combat that divine providence requires of us, without our succumbing to fatigue, weariness, or to the siren song of legality. Well said. What our Lord requires is martyrdom endured drop by drop. What our Lord requires is martyrdom endured drop by drop. Oh, what fun. But that's exactly it. You know, and that's exactly it for all of us. Martyrdom endured drop by drop. And a clear and simple profession of Catholic faith without compromising with the modernists in the Vatican. The Pope, yes. Legality, yes. But above all, the response to God's clear call. The combat of the faith. The day the Pope really converts
it will appear more clearly than the light of day. And again, that's so true. The day the Pope converts, it'll be obvious. And then the problem's over. Obviously, it is not by kissing the Quran or by going to pray in a mosque that he manifests this conversion, nor by the rerun of Assisi, which happened within days of the agreement between Campos and Rome. All the faithful of the chapels in Rio and Niteroi are praying for you, beseeching the Blessed Virgin Mary to turn your hearts to the light of truth in Christo et Maria. I'm very glad to answer a few questions, if there are a few questions. I totally agree with Don Lawrence. Father Couture?
Campos said anything about Assisi?
I don't believe so. It's an understood part of the contract that you're no longer to go on attacking. In theory, Rome said, oh, please attack, please help us to fight heresy. There you are. But attack their heresies, impossible. You can't do it. That's against the whole spirit of the agreement.
How far did we see the whole thing coming?
That's an interesting question. How far did we see the whole thing coming? I can remember in a meeting of Sisi Nono, a Congress of Sisi Nono held in Rome in 2000, just before the pilgrimage. I can remember listening to Father Rifan talking like a sedevacantist, asking the sedevacantist question. And I said to myself, what's going on? And now, of course, from sedevacantism to liberalism, from liberalism to sedevacantism, it's the flip side of the coin. It's heads and tails of the coin. So Father Rifan was certainly personally insecure. There was something. I said to myself, something's going on. Nobody else made any fuss about it, but I noticed it then. I didn't know what it meant. I'd known him for many years. I suppose that he was, you know, being tempted free moments by sedevacantism, but he was losing his balance. I don't know how and I don't know why. For the Campos priest as a whole, how has anybody seen this coming? Not to my knowledge. They asked me down just a year ago, February of last year. They had three ordinations to do, priestly ordinations, and Don Rangel, Bishop Rangel, was too ill. So I went down a Saturday and I went down a Friday and came back Sunday. I was down there just a couple of days in order to do the ordinations for them. I noticed then, this is a year ago, now I look back, I can see that a year ago they were perfectly friendly, but there was something missing. There was a spark missing. There was something missing. I didn't think of it at the time, but looking back I can see it. But so it must have been prepared. It must have been preparing for a while. Yes. I don't know what the real problem is. My guess, some of you have seen in public in the letter, I say it's a case of 50ism. In other words, the Campos priests were never really vaccinated against Vatican II like all of us who have been born and bred in Archbishop Lefebvre's society. The mass of us here have been born and bred in the Archbishop. We've been vaccinated. We were born vaccinated, so to speak. They weren't. They were born before the council, and Bishop de Castromaya made the passage comparatively painless from prior to council to our post-council. And so those priests never directly went through the wars of the faith. And therefore, they never really understood what the problem is really about. Father Scott said to me last night, they've been legalistic. I don't know that, but it's very possible. Father Scott says they're very good at the legal arguments. And of course, if you take today's problem at the level of the law, you're not going to see the huge problem of faith. Somebody who has seen the problem of faith is Professor Derman, who wrote his three books about the theology of the meeting of Assisi, the Assisi meeting of 1986. And he's written, he's written four books actually, three of them he translated into English. When Assisi happened, you may remember, Professor Derman said, what's going on? And he said, and he wasn't a traditionalist, he wasn't saying the true mass, and so on and so on and so on, but he said, what's going on? A very good German mind, a German scholarly mind. And he said, I've got to study everything that this Pope has said and written in order to find out what he's thinking. And so he set himself to do exactly that. And he said, one of his conclusions was, now I begin to understand Archbishop Lefebvre. It's not just a problem of liturgy. And this scholar, this serious Germanic scholar said, it's a problem of the very foundations of the faith. It's a problem of the very foundations of the faith. The very foundations of the mind, let alone of the faith. The foundations of the mind are rocking. The very grip on any reality is missing. You can't get more basic than that. Father Kurtz. Very good question. I have no such indication. That's astonishing. But that's when Bishop de Gallarete went down there, I think about September of last year, at Bishop Philly's invitation, in order to talk with them and to try to warn them and persuade them, he met a united front. He did not meet the 24 priests. He met their guiding committee of 6, Loctite. It's very strange. I've got to believe that sooner or later some of those priests will break ranks. I've got to believe. But for the moment, and the laity, but what's happened with the laity, perhaps, a seminarian told me that his mother, who's in contact with one of the Brazilian parishioners in Campos, said that this Brazilian parishioner in Campos asked her what's going on, because the parishioner in the United States knows more about what's going on in Brazil than the laity themselves, which strongly suggests that the priests have been operating hidden from the laity, so to speak. They've been keeping quiet from the laity what they were up to, and the laity being quietly led along. The laity being led where they don't know, and that's why perhaps there's been no reaction amongst the laity. But there's, to my knowledge, been very little reaction. Father officers. Yes. Yep. And it's the way the Novus Ordo, the priests are acting with the whole mass of faithful at the time of Vatican II. No, nothing's been changed, don't worry, then another little change. Nothing's been changed, don't worry, another little change. Until the whole thing was completely turned upside down. On the contrary, Archbishop Lefebvre, right out in the open. The children of light operate in light, the children of darkness operate in darkness. And operating in darkness is not a good sign of children of light. Father De Merode. Yes. That's a very good question. I don't think it does turn all around that. I think that whatever goes on paper is not really significant. I'm afraid it's not significant, because you know, good paper and bad men, or which do you prefer, a good piece of paper and bad men, or a bad piece of paper and good men? Obviously.
What I mean is, if it's kept secret or if it's unpublished,
that's another bad sign.
It's not bad. It's a blank check.
A blank check to Rome.
Yeah.
Yes, that's it. I think that's what it is. There's the answer to your question, Father.
Yes.
Thank you, Father. Father Gentili, thank you. Father Lees.
Do we know of any provision for replacing this brand new one?
Father Rifan probably wanted to replace Bishop Rangel or be the successor, because Bishop Rangel is ill with cancer and a successor will be needed. But of course, but Monsignor Pearl has already said to somebody in Italy who we know and who contacted Bishop Foley about it, and what he said to this Italian was, it's not going to be Father Rangel. And what he also said, what Monsignor Pearl also said in private to the Italian is, yes. That's it. It's just an interim puppet show to bring them back in. Don't worry about it. And of course, the Pope's theologian Father Cottier said something essentially similar. That what is it? Union has a dynamic of its own which will mature. You know, they're going to fall into our clutches. Clear. Couldn't be clearer. Yes. See, that's the blank check. The blank check. They're mad. Absolutely mad. But you see, even if they had a Loctite agreement, people like this, there's no such thing as Loctite in these minds. So you've got, there's no way they could guarantee anything. Any other questions? Time is going on. Father Zendekas.
I don't know, when you embrace in Campbell, what is the viewpoint that we have?
The societies. The society's second assistant
was present at the agreement, the I'll call it a slush bash, because a bash is a kind of party. It was a kind of party, and slush in the mind. Everybody's slushing together. Let's call it the slush bash. Extremely common language, but at least clear. Father Alagna went down to the slush bash against the express prohibition of Bishop Foley. And he took part, and he came back rejoicing about the agreement and so on and so on. I'm afraid, dear Father Alagna, who we all of us, some of us know and all of us love, he's a very good guy, a real fighting Gaul. But, you know, the Gauls, they have some great qualities. They do also have a few defects. But Father Alagna is a great Gaul. He's losing it. He's losing it. But don't worry, it's not the first time it's happened. Before 1988, Father Bizik was the second assistant of the society, and he left the society. He was second assistant, and he headed up St. Peter's because he thought the Archbishop was wrong. So it's not the first time we've lost a second assistant, and it's not going to be the last time. I don't know whether we're going to lose Father Alagna, but certainly his head is gone. And what's happened in his particular case, I'm venturing to say, that his Roman heart has got to his head. He wants, he feels Rome, he feels, he loves, he feels, he loves, he feels, he loves. He stops thinking. And if you don't think, you lose grip of this gigantic problem. The faith is seated, says St. Thomas Aquinas, that's reality, in the intellect, not in the heart. It's in the mind. The faith is under the push of the will. The will pushes the intellect to assent to an object which the intellect by its own powers cannot see. But it's the intellect that believes, not the will. And so if you allow the heart to move the intellect all over the place, that's what's happened. So one last question, if anybody has one. Father Beck.
If the terms don't matter, how can we justify our devotion?
Well, the society doesn't justify negotiations, and it hasn't justified them, and the society's backed off negotiations. I think Bishop Foley and Father Schmidberger and Father Alagna were tempted towards the beginning of last year. They were tempted because, you know, because in theory, and in there might be a great good come of an agreement. So an agreement is always desirable, and I think, you know, Cardinal Hoyos was singing a siren song, and he has a, you know, big smile going from one ear to the other, charming fellow, and so on and so on. He gave three of us a lunch with six courses and 15 different kinds of nuts, and he himself was the 16th. Charming, nice, sweet. For a moment, you know, it looked as though Rome might be serious, but as Don Lawrence says, when they come to their senses, it's going to be obvious. They will eat. What do you say in American? They will eat humble pie. One expression. They will eat crow. They will eat crow from the North Pole to the South Pole and back again. And because of the truth, they will be proud to eat crow. And people will come at them with AK-47s, and they will say, "Be my guest. I've been a blank, blank fool. You kill me, and I'll go straight to heaven. Please, boom, pull the trigger." That's what they're going to say. Some of these, not many of them, but if they see the truth, if they come back to the truth, that's the kind of thing we're going to see, and it'll be very, very clear. Until then, what does God require of us? Fidelity. And He doesn't require of us great numbers. He does require of us fidelity. We've got to testify. He wants us to testify. We've got to keep the undiluted truth.